I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Negotiations between warring countries or factions can be more complicated than news reports suggest. Sometimes secret dialogues have to lay the groundwork for those public dealings, and we're about to meet somebody who has been a clandestine international peace broker.
My guest is Joe Elder. He's the professor of sociology, culture, and languages of Asia at the UW-Madison. It's going to be a fast-paced conversation, I think, given all the experience you've had. And I gather some of it, though it took place years ago, coming relatively recently to light. Why were you, in specific, involved in these negotiations?
I think a series of things that I had done and then a series of historical events that I had no control over. I became interested in India right after college. The first job I had after finishing Oberlin College was to go to Madurai, South India, and teach English, for which I was totally unqualified, had no preparation, knew no Tamil language. But in the 2 years I was teaching English there, I became fascinated by India and decided that whatever degree I got, I wanted to focus on India. I decided on sociology, because that's what I'd already started. Then I decided if I'm going to specialize in India, I better also learn the North Indian language, Hindi, which is much more widely used. So I was lucky to get a grant from the Ford Foundation to study a foreign language throughout my graduate career. I ended up spending 2 years in a village in North India with my wife and two kids living in a tent, in which case there was nobody in the village who spoke English, so my Hindi became quite good. Came back, got my degree. First job was teaching in Oberlin College, which was fine. It was my alma mater. But in a small liberal arts college, I was allowed to teach sort of one course on India and the rest was sort of standard stuff. At that point, the University of Wisconsin received a grant to become a research center for South Asia. And I had a phone call from Henry Hart in the political science department, and he described heaven to me, which proved to be true. So I came here in 1961 in two departments, sociology and at that time Indian studies. And ever since, I've had this great focus on South Asia and also sociology. So that got me set up in the field. I became a Quaker during the war with Korea. I had to decide, was I going to enlist or be drafted, and I had seen what happened during wars. I was a kid growing up in Iran. My parents were missionaries. And I said, I can't be trained to kill anybody. So I said this was something I couldn't do. So I either would go to prison or I would do something else. And my draft board was very kind and said, okay, we don't send you to prison, but do something else. That also got me involved with the Quakers, who have a long history of being opposed to wars and refusing to use violence. So as a Quaker South Asia specialist, that's where everything sort of came together. I was here. I was chair of the department, and a war had broken out between India and Pakistan in 1965. An ugly war. It lasted about 2 weeks. A lot of officers were killed on both sides. Pakistan conquered some Indian territory. India conquered some Pakistan territory. And then a ceasefire was called, but there was no peace. It was just a temporary halting of fighting. So that went on from September, October, November with no ultimate resolution to it. And now the fact that I was an India specialist entered in, because during the struggle for independence, when Gandhi was working against the British, he used Quakers to carry messages.
Did he?
Here were Quakers who were Englishmen or English women, and they could carry messages to the viceroy, and then the viceroy could write a letter and they could carry it back to the prison in which he was. So there was this sort of odd dialogue with Quakers who were sympathetic to Gandhi and Gandhi's nonviolence and also British citizens. So it occurred to the British Quakers that since this had worked a little bit in the struggle for independence, maybe there was some goodwill there that the Quakers could use to get in touch with Pakistanis and Indians and see if there was something useful that could happen. So they came with the idea of why don't we send some Quakers? They wanted both British and American. They found two British senior Quakers, both well experienced in India. They're looking for an American Quaker who knew something about India. Bing, here we came. Okay. So I had the phone call and it said, Joe, would you be interested in going on a fact-finding mission to India and Pakistan with two other Quakers, sort of following on the legacy of the Quakers with Gandhi? And I said, you know, I would love to, but I'm chair of the department, the budget, this, that, the other. So realistically, I can't possibly do it. And I hung up. I turned to my secretary and I said, I just turned out a fantastic offer. And she said, what was it? And I said, a chance to go to India with these two Quakers and see if there was something we might do that might be helpful. And she said, why did you say no? And I said, well, I'm important. I have to sort of take care of it. And she said three wonderful words, who needs you? Yeah, right. And I said, what do you mean? She said, look, there are two other people who've been chair of the department. They'll be happy to step in. Call those guys back. So I got on the phone. Within 50 minutes, I said, is the job offer still open? And they said, yes. So within 2 weeks, I was in Washington meeting the Indian ambassador and the Pakistani ambassador, explaining to them what was going to happen. And then as soon as winter break came, I flew to England and met the two other Quakers. So that's how I sort of got launched on this thing, because I was not necessary back on the Madison campus.
It helps, I suppose.
Who needs you?
But now you mentioned, Joe, that you spent all this time in India.
Yeah.
Did the Pakistanis have any qualms about you being biased at all, or are you just carrying messages?
The key thing, it was interesting, they were angrier. Both sides had different attitudes for British and Americans, which was kind of cute. It meant that when we were in Pakistan, they liked America. So they would speak to me and ignore the two Englishmen. We'd be in India, they'd ignore me and speak to the other way.
Now, I can see why they would ignore the English because of the colonial history
involving both
India and Pakistan.
Right.
But why would the Indians be antithetical to America?
Well, they felt that at that point, the U.S. was sort of allied with Pakistan. We had arms treaties and stuff like that. So it was kind of bizarre to have this thing where they turn their backs and say, talking to you about that. But what impressed us most was we arrived early in January. And in the interim, the Soviet Union had decided to play a broker on this operation. They called the president of Pakistan and the prime minister of India to Tashkent. And they worked out a Tashkent declaration, which essentially said, let's return the prisoners, let's let the civilians go back together, let's restore things to normal, let's end this ceasefire and have a peace treaty. So the peace treaty was signed as we were on our way to India and Pakistan. The day after it was signed, Prime Minister Lal Bahadur Shastri from India had a heart attack and died. So there was this treaty that had been signed by President Ayub Khan of Pakistan and Prime Minister Shastri from India, that now was sort of hanging in the open. Each of them had promised not to yield to the other. They said, we're not going to give up an inch of territory. Our sons died fighting for it.
Right.
So they both had to sort of go back and face a hostile audience. And the question was, would this thing even hold out? So that was the moment at which we arrived. We went to Karachi first, which was in Pakistan. Very quickly, remarkably quickly, when they heard the word Quaker, they gave us access to various people who had often worked with Quakers when India was a single country. And then within less than a week, we had an invitation to meet President Ayub Khan. So this was going from being three people who were sort of, can we find something to do, to go meet the president of Pakistan, who was suffering the humiliation of having to come back and go back on his word. But it was, in a sense, the only thing that he could do. Go ahead.
The difference between India and Pakistan is primarily religious?
Yes. At the time of India's independence, about 20% of the population were Muslim and 80% Hindu, give or take. And the Muslims were concentrated in the northwest and the northeast. So for a long time, Gandhi had hoped that they could all stay together. But as independence approached, the Muslims in the northwest and northeast felt less and less comfortable that once it's independence, we're going to begin losing power. They'll ignore our wishes and so on. And when Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the spokesperson for the independence of Pakistan, stepped in and said, the only solution to this is going to be an independent India and an independent Pakistan in two sections. It was something that Nehru agreed to with great reluctance, and Gandhi was extremely sad and had no choice. He said, this is not at all what I've been working for. So on Independence Day, Gandhi actually fasted. He was not at all celebrating the fact that this was cut into two. The two governments looked a lot like each other. The constitutions were almost identical. In Pakistan, the president had to be a Muslim, and I think the governor general had to be a Muslim, but that was the only sort of reference to Islam. The rest was the secular laws and voting and camera legislation and all the rest. So there wasn't that much difference. And then the army had to be divided into a Pakistani army and an Indian army. So often you had people who'd gone to cadet school together and been in the same camp together now opposed to each other. And this was fairly complicated. Actually, one thing that we saw while we were there on this first trip was the generals meeting to settle the question of returning prisoners of war. We had no idea how spooky that was, because keeping records in a war is pretty chaotic. The International Red Cross had come to supervise this, and these were three civilians from Switzerland. And their job was to make sure that every name of a prisoner the Pakistanis had went back to India, and every name the Indians had went back to Pakistan. And very quickly they discovered each side was hiding people.
Hiding people?
These were officers that they just wanted not to let go back. So there was this spooky world where they were saying, we think there are two or three people that India has not told us, and if you tell us of two or three people you're hiding, we might be able to get them loose. But they had this feeling that when it was done, there could be somebody who would be forever left in some sort of prisoner of war camp. So they were doing that while we were there. We also watched the two generals meet to sign whatever the document. And ironically, the Pakistani general was a Muslim, and India sent a Muslim general to be there.
Oh, did
so
they?
Two Muslim generals, one from India and one from Pakistan.
And Pakistan, though, when you say it's divided, it was
East Pakistan and West Pakistan.
And separated by a big chunk
by
of geography.
900 miles, yeah. That's right, yeah. And eventually, East Pakistan became a separate country, being Bangladesh.
Yes, right.
A decade or so later.
Were you at all involved then in visiting prisoners of war or anything like that, or were you reserved strictly for
negotiations? It was mostly carrying messages back and forth. Mm-hmm. We were impressed that President Ayub Khan even gave us the time, but it was clear he was very serious about this. And then he said something which I hadn't really realized. He said, you know, when countries go to war, the first thing they do is to break off any way of communicating. You shut your embassies, you close down your high commission officers.
With your opponent.
With your opponent. And then there's nobody to talk to.
Yeah.
So you hear the barrage of hostile things on the other side, and you're depending upon spies and all sorts of things. And you're making decisions based on flawed information. And the fact that you could go on the other side and carry a message is something I deeply appreciate, and could come back with messages on that side. So we realized that sort of inadvertently we were there at a good time when he did want to have a message sent to India. Ironically, when he first met him, India still didn't have a prime minister. Lal Bahadur Shastri had died, and there was a sort of struggle for who would become the next prime minister. And then lo and behold, it was Indira Gandhi, Prime Minister Nehru's daughter. So when we went from Pakistan to India on our first trip, he had asked us to meet whoever the prime minister was. And there was Indira Gandhi. And Indira Gandhi remembered the Quakers, remembers Horace Alexander, who carried messages for her father and so on. So we had a very friendly meeting with her. And I will never forget that meeting. We went into the prime minister's office, and there was a table with, you know, Life magazine, and Illustrated Weekly, and all had Indira Gandhi's picture on it,
sure, yes.
And then in she comes. And it's sort of, okay, we've seen you before.
So if you compare these two leaders, the Pakistani and, we'll say, Indira Gandhi, I get the impression from what you've said so far, Joe, that they were both rather warm and cordial and reasonable people.
They certainly to us, they were, mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, at one point, one of the other Quakers said, it seems to me that the higher you go, the cooler to the heads. That you have the people down below who have to look tough and argue, but up at the top, these are people who know how complex a situation is, know that if things don't work out, lives will be lost and a lot of damage will occur. So they're looking for ways around a situation which may seem intractable. And here, if they can get in contact with the other side, recognizing they also realize there's a lot of bluster, a lot of bluff, we're not going to give an inch and so mm-hmm. on. But when it comes to the real world, if we can work something out, we'd much rather do that.
Yeah, history has plenty of examples of that, doesn't it? Right. 54-40 or fight kind of thing, you know?
Right, yeah. And it's down here, the guy's saying, we're not going to give an inch. And well, come on, let's cool it. Let's be realistic about it.
So in the sequence of events, there was a ceasefire in place when you went over.
That's right.
To convey these messages.
Then there was
the Soviets brokered the peace treaty.
Yeah.
And
Then there was the implementation of the treaty.
So you were helping to implement it as much as anything else.
Mostly just get the dialogue going. Mm-hmm. And it was going already, and the fact that then could the head of Pakistan communicate with the head of India during this process with replacing Prime Minister Indira Gandhi with Prime Minister Lal Bahadur Shastri, who died. So there was a sort of non-junction of what was going on.
So did it hold?
It did. Mm-hmm. And not forever. There's another war before long.
We're talking about 19...
This was 65.
65, right, okay.
And the next war wasn't until 71, so we'll take our breaks as they come.
And you, from the distance of 6 years and now several thousand miles, being back in Wisconsin, I assume.
Yeah.
How did you react to that? What were you thinking when the 1971 conflict broke out?
71 was... not directly related to the Kashmir issue, which had been the trigger in the first one.
There was big a piece of
section
geography.
That Pakistan said Kashmir is ours, India said Kashmir is ours, and the war was over that.
And if you see that on a map, I remember as a kid, it would be striped.
It is.
One country would be green, the other might be white, and Kashmir was green and white striped.
Each one claims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
a big claim.
I heard a cartographer, a friend of mine, who published a book of maps in the area, and he had a terrible time getting the book shown in either Pakistan or India. That line is not right. And he could say, this is the ceasefire line. No, that doesn't count. This is, it's all of ours or it's all of ours.
So 65 was about Kashmir. What was it about in 71?
It was Bangladesh trying to become independent, East Pakistan becoming mm-hmm. independent from West Pakistan. It needn't have happened, but your comment that there were 900 miles between the two meant a lot of things. The people in the East spoke a completely different language. It was Bengali. They didn't speak Urdu. The official language was Urdu. The Bengalis had a long, proud history of literature and culture. And as the economy worked, the West became the economic powerhouse, and the East became where you sold rice and sugar cane and took the money from there to the powerhouse. So as the years went on, it got more and more strained. We are being exploited by the West. Until finally there was an election. The East technically won. The West said, forget it. We're not going to let your party run us. And a civil war broke out. Broke out in March of 71. And it was one of these horrible things where 10 million people from East Pakistan fled because it was so awful. India entered to help the Bangladeshis in a sort of a two-week war and defeated Pakistan and created a new state, Bangladesh. And then India did something pretty impressive. They had said, we're only going in to solve this problem. We're not going to take Bangladesh over. And within 2 months, they left Bangladesh holding something like 80,000 prisoners still, which they weren't going to let go for a while. So the prisoner issue remained for a couple of years until it was sorted out, and Pakistan officially apologized to Bangladesh. But that was a whole sort of different issue. For a while, the Quakers asked if I would be prepared to go into that situation, but it happened so quickly, ended so quickly, there was no entry point. But it could have been a mission if it had taken longer.
Next, we'll look at conflict in Sri Lanka, a long-running conflict, and see how the peace brokers came to terms with that. It's University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joe Elder, and we're looking at his career as an international peace broker, having looked at India and Pakistan. Now we're going to look at the conflict, a long-running conflict in Sri Lanka.
Well, there was another long-standing conflict that India was involved with, and a place that we don't think of every day as we do of Pakistan, and that's what used to be called Ceylon and
that's
now
right.
Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm. Sri Lanka became independent about the same time India did, 1 year later. A long colonial history, the Dutch were there, the British were there. The majority population in Sri Lanka are Buddhist. But once again, geography becomes important. Their is a section of Tamil-speaking Sri Lankans. Okay, here you have India here with the Tamils in the south and the Tamils in the northern part of Sri Lanka. They're Hindu, mostly. And during the British period, the Tamils were kind of intrigued by the British culture. They went to the colleges, they became the lawyers, they became the journalists, the academics. Whereas the Sinhalas, the Buddhists, kept a little bit apart and continued studying the Buddhist tradition. So when Sri Lanka became independent, very quickly this minority group of Tamils were sort of running things. And tensions began to emerge as to who's going to get into college and who's going to be paying, getting elected and so on. And the Sinhalas being the majority, they finally decided, enough is enough. We're going to say, if you don't speak our language, you're going to be second-class citizens. We're going to restrict the number of Tamil kids getting to college so the Sinhala kids can get into college. So a series of provisions went in there where now the Tamils, who were had been kind of the upper group but the minority, now said, this is impossible. We can't go on forever and ever. So a war broke out in 1984. With the militant Tamils setting up a group called the Tamil Tigers,
right,
and they became a guerrilla movement fighting against the Sri Lanka government. Ironically, India tried to be the bargain maker here. India said, look, this is terrible. So for a brief period of time, the Indian army sent a peacekeeping force to stand between the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lanka government. Within 2 months, they were being attacked by the Tigers and by the nobody liked them, and it was the worst defeat in India's history up to that time because they were losing soldiers from both sides, and finally they just had to withdraw. It wasn't working out. So what they hoped was going to be a fairly quick ceasefire settlement went on and on and on into the 200s and 2000s before it was finally ended.
And this is in case you missed it. Sri Lanka is an island.
It's an island off the southern tip of India.
Yeah, some distance from India.
Yeah.
So a thing unto itself in a way.
Right, and its own history and a long heritage. And actually, the Buddhists there feel about Sri Lanka almost like Jews feel about Palestine. The story is that Buddha, who was teaching in North India, sent a prince and a group of colonists to settle in Sri Lanka and make it a Buddhist country. Now, whether it's accurate or not is an open question, but they
do. That's the way they feel about
it. But Sinhala is a North Indian language. It's an Indo-European language, and Tamil is a Dravidian language. So there seems to be some basis on the fact that this is a group of people who came from the north to found a Buddhist country. So when the tensions began to build up, the Sinhala sort of said to the Tamils, if you don't like it here, go back to India.
Which was centuries later.
Uh-huh. But it got very, very ugly. In 1984, there was one of these horrible moments when a city goes crazy. The city of Colombo was the capital. And the Tigers had attacked a vehicle full of Sinhala soldiers and killed them all. And the government of Sri Lanka decided to have a royal funeral for these young men who'd lost their lives. And that led to a riot, which then led to a pogrom against the Tamils. And for 4 or 5 days, it was any Tamil living in Sri Lanka was in great danger of himself. So it was at that time, a year later, by the Quakers in Britain once again said, why don't we see if there's some way we can move into this? So since I was now an experienced message carrier, they got in touch with me. And I said, sure. So there were two of us who went, a British, very, very thoughtful, very experienced British Quaker, named Adam Curl, and myself. And we went to Sri Lanka to see if there were anything that we could do drawing upon the Indian experience. And we now kind of had a premise that we could lay before people saying, we've done this in India. It seems that when things fall apart, it's very hard for people to speak to each other. So if you do want us to speak to each other, we're happy to carry a message. We don't write anything. We will do this if both sides want us to carry messages. We won't become an advocate for one or the other.
And when you say you won't write anything down or we won't distribute anything to the press?
We won't write any messages.
Really?
There's nothing that they can take from us. So here is something.
Uh-huh.
It was just whatever we knew.
So you had to be particularly sure you had your facts straight.
That's
in
right.
Your head.
Right. And it's very useful to have two people.
Yes,
we
sure.
sit down afterwards
and notes.
Try to go back over how did you interpret that. And it is eerie how you don't quite hear the same thing, even if you're both listening. So the provision was, we'll carry messages to the other side and bring them back, provided both sides want to do it. The minute either one says they don't, we're going to stop. And the other is, you must promise us absolute confidentiality. You can't tell anybody you're with us, and we aren't going to tell anybody, because the minute that becomes public and the press is watching and yeah. caught in, you know, people asking you trick questions. So as far as I know, we carried messages from 1984 till 1996, which is 12 years, periodically, you know, during, I was in India and Sri Lanka on university business, and various British Quakers came and would join me. So there was sort of a team of us who would meet and intersect.
So what do you do, just kind of quietly slip away to
well,
do this work?
It's winter vacation. I was in charge of the College Year in India program for many years, which meant that every January I had to go to India to see how the students were doing.
But once you're in India,
you're just practically there. You know,
right, sure. But I mean, you say, well, you know, I'm going to go have dinner with
I'll
somebody. I'll see you tomorrow.
A week or something. Uh-huh, I would yeah. say.
Just have to be kind of vague.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm going to Sri Lanka to check up on things or something like that. As far as I know, we only were aware of one time where somebody, the story was that somebody at an embassy party had blurted out that there were Quakers moving around. But we were never stopped or asked about it, so we were happy to keep our heads as far down as we could. And we met in the most incredible places. The first trip we made, okay, 1984, it was the anniversary of the 84 massacre, it was 1985. And there was fear that this pogrom might break out again, a lot of tension. So Adam Curl and I arrived, and there were a lot of people who were concerned about trying to get a dialogue going, but no connection. They were having peace vigils and candles and stuff, but nothing intrinsic. And then somebody said, you know, the Deputy Minister of Defense studied in Britain. He might be worth talking to. So we arranged to meet him. And there was one of those incredible breakthroughs. He was the voice of attack on the Tamils. He had these radio programs where, as Undersecretary Minister of Defense, he would say, Tamils, give up. We're getting new weapons. The Israelis have given us a new boat. We know where you are. Surrender before you lose anything more. You're doomed. So this didn't seem like the greatest guy to meet.
No, not the greatest to start with.
So we met him. And he starts right off by saying, look, I know Quakers. I stayed in Quaker dormitory when I was in England. And I would love to have you carry a message to the Tigers. And this is the message. I know they can't beat us. I know we can't beat them. So we got to talk.
Well, that's great. Very different, isn't it?
Right. Enormously different from the official position.
Sure.
So he said, are you serious? You know, I'm realistic. I can't beat them. They're a guerrilla force. They can keep going on and more or less indefinitely. And I want them to know it. So we did arrange to go to Madras, where the Tigers were organized. It meant there were actually at that time five different groups of Tigers. It gets very complicated, leadership and policy and so on. And two of them would not meet with the other three.
I was wondering, yes. Competition among them.
who is the voice of the Tamil Tigers. The building we met in for the three that would agree to meet us had a mortar attack the day before, so there's still sort of a hole in the ceiling that had come in. And the person we wanted to speak to was the head of the Tiger group, a guy named Prabhakaran. And they said, Prabhakaran is very difficult to meet him. But they kept looking at the ceiling. So he said, well, could you pass back to him the message we're carrying from the Deputy Minister of Defense, whose name was well known by everybody because he had this very hardline position he was taking. So we had this dialogue with the eyes keeping going up to the ceiling where we
waiting for the next one.
Was probably keeping his ear. And they were thunderstruck. Did he actually say he can't beat us? Uh-huh. He said, yeah, well, we knew he couldn't, but we didn't think he realized you can't beat gorillas if they're in you know, setting with the people and invisible.
But on the other hand,
we can't beat them. So at some point, you're going to sit down and talk that. So that began the dialogue, and that continued on and off for nearly 12 years, with each side still saying they wanted us to carry messages.
They were fighting all this time?
Yeah, sporadically. The line kept shifting between where. But it was a weird thing because the Tigers controlled the northern section of Sri Lanka. So you almost had to get a visa from the Tigers to cross over into this area. And there's a kind of weird no man's land. And then you had to get your Sri Lankan visa to get in here. But it meant that everything we did, we had to inform the Sri Lanka government we were doing and get clearance from them and the military people. And we had to get work with the Tiger in the various places where we would contact the Tigers. So there were some pretty odd moments there where you're sort of in no man's land.
Was this conflict aimed strictly at the military, or did it have a component of ethnic cleansing to it?
It was very much an ethnic cleansing kind of thing.
It was.
The Tamils maintained that they were forever going to be an oppressed minority. Look at what had happened in the past. They needed a separate Tamil Elam, is what they call the Tamil land. And the middle of the road, people said, well, could we give you a region? Could you give some place you have your own language, your own police force?
Sort of a semi-autonomous thing.
Let's work this thing out. And that was sort of, we had the policy of never having a Quaker position. We were going to say, this is our position. Because the minute a flaw is discovered in it, then you're lost. We say, our job is just to carry messages between you two. But personally, we hoped there would be some reasonable way where a region, a Tamil region could be established and this thing could be worked out. And there were Tigers we met who said, sure, we could work this thing out. But Prabhakaran was a hardliner, and we never met Prabhakaran. He was always the next person. He was the next room. He was the next building. We'd speak to the lower-level Tigers, and they were some of them were extremely reasonable, very well-educated. And they'd say, well, we'll speak to Prabhakaran. And then we meet them the next morning. He always says no. Mm-hmm. So this sort of thing that went on and on. That finally ended when there had been an attack on the president of Sri Lanka, and she lost sight of one of her eyes. And she said, enough is enough. They're just playing games. They're not serious about this. So I was in Sri Lanka at the time with an English Quaker. We had clearance. We're all set to go. And then we got the word, no, they're just playing games. So I never went on the last trip in to speak with the Tigers.
How did it resolve then?
It was horrible. The worst possible ending. It went on until about, I guess, 2011 or 2012, when the Tigers were bottled up in a corner of Sri Lanka, and then Prabhakaran refused to surrender. And so the Sri Lankan army just shelled the area where these people were, and it was a grim massacre where nobody knows how many people lost their lives, most of them civilians. And eventually, Prabhakaran was killed, but his body was still clearly, I mean, a very visible face. So his corpse was carried around to show that he really was dead. And then since then, the war ended with the Sri Lanka army winning, the Tamils losing. And it's not been a happy scene. It's inching toward maybe a little better than last elections. But the Tamils have been sort of told, you were treacherous at one point. We don't trust you at all. There probably are seeds of tigers still around, so we're not going to give you the sort of breaks that you would need if we wanted to be really friendly.
Next, we're going to look at the peace broker experience when it came to the conflicts in North and South Korea and North and South Vietnam. It's University of the Air, resuming right after this here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joe Elder, and we're looking at his career as an international peace broker.
How did you get involved in the negotiations between North and South Vietnam, which were notorious for their complexity and their kind of arbitrary resistance to each other?
That emerged from, again, a sort of Quaker philosophy that's evolved over the centuries, which is when wars break out, the people who suffer most almost always are civilians. And the effort that's made and the money that's spent is typically on the military on both sides. So as soon as the war in Vietnam became clearly a civil war, the Quakers looked about what they could do for the South Vietnamese. And they set up a hospital for taking care of amputations and burns, the two things that the civilians were suffering from most. Napalm, and it was a terrible sort of thing. And then a lot of arms blown off and legs blown off with the booby traps and all the rest. So they were doing that. They had a staff of people, and they worked throughout the war in this, especially exclusively for civilians. But what do you do about the victims in North Vietnam?
Yeah.
That's hard to get to. And the Quaker leaders approached them and said, we'd like to do something, but what can we do since we're American? And they said, obviously, there's not very much you can do it for the while.
It's so politically charged. I mean, anybody just... any American just going to North Vietnam, if you got any kind of press coverage, which of course I know you would avoid, but I mean, the notorious Jane Fonda incident.
That's right. Got a lot of press publicity, which was very awkward in the end. So in the summer of 69, I had agreed to spend the summer in Southeast Asia. President Nixon had come in and said the war was going to end. He had a peace plan. It took 6 years before it happened, but anyway.
Yeah, he's a little vague.
And the
about
plan
it,
was the Quakers are always too late thinking, so let's get ahead. So I was sent, going to go to Thailand and look at the Mekong River Project, which is an international, intercultural project to link up the river, communists, non-communists, and then plan what the Quakers could do when the war ended. So I was on my way to Thailand with another group of Quakers who were meeting in Stockholm with a delegation from North Vietnam. And since we were the biggest delegation, there are five Quakers, there are other peace groups, we were sitting with Madam Bin, the foreign secretary. And the executive secretary of the Quakers said, Madam Bin, can you think of any way in which we could do something for the civilians of the North? And she said, yeah, I think the time has come. If you would send somebody, we could probably work something out. So he reaches over and said, here's our man. So I suddenly changed my plans for the summer. I was not going to go to Bangkok and do the Mekong River Project, but I was going to go into North Vietnam and see what we could do. So I arranged and went to Paris, got a visa. Well, sorry to get the visa. Went to Phnom Penh in Cambodia. There's this weird world where some countries are neutral and some countries aren't.
Very
and some countries
off
are hostile.
For
That's right. And got my visa to go into Hanoi. So I flew into Hanoi the end of June.
That had to be rather weird.
It was a bit weird, yeah.
Because you didn't know, at what point the Americans would be attacking. I mean, they certainly had bombed Hanoi and Haiphong and all kinds of points in North Vietnam.
Right.
Was that coordinated at all? I mean, do you have any idea where they would be?
We had no idea where they were going to be, but we had kept the State Department informed of what we were doing, because this was all
illegal.
Hopefully
there would be some trickle down.
Somebody would say. In fact, my job was, as possible, to check in with the ambassador in the countries, saying, here I am, a Quaker, we're doing this sort of thing. And it was very funny with the ambassador in Vientiane, the capital of Laos, where I was talking with the ambassador's wife over lunch, and she said, how can you be an anti-war activist? You're so nice. interesting world. We also met the ambassador in Saigon. So let him know what we were doing, but all the time it was, in a sense, the purpose being there are civilians who are hurting and we're concerned about them. So I spent a week in North Vietnam as the guest of the country. There was a committee of people who were with me all the time, translators and a person of the Communist Party. And at the end of the week, they gave me a list, which blew my mind. It was all in French. And it was a list of open-heart surgical supplies and equipment. Nobody had said anything about open-heart surgery.
But they
at
were
all.
Requesting.
They were requesting. Mm-hmm. We had raised $35,000, Canadian Quakers and American Quakers, to do something for the civilians. And so I came, how would you like us to spend this? So there was this strange request, and they had the catalogs from which they got them. They obviously had somebody who knew what they were doing. So I came back to Philadelphia and said, this is what they want. Puzzled by the request, but committed to getting it. There was a fair amount of publicity when I came back because there weren't that many people in and out of North Vietnam. I did meet a number of senators and folks who were curious about it. We met Henry Kissinger a couple of times in connection with what we were doing. And then I went back in to try to deliver the supplies in August. Had a weird experience. I got to Vientiane with all these boxes with heart valves and sphygmomanometers and all the stuff that was needed. Because when you have open heart surgery, you had to have something taking care of the moving the blood while you were doing the operation. And I got a visa to fly in from Vientiane to Hanoi. Plane got halfway there, turned around and came back, said bad weather. That happened three times or something. Wait a minute, this is... And each time you had to get another visa and move all the boxes and all the rest. Also on this trip, I was carrying letters from relatives of men who had been shot down,
POWs.
Who might be alive or might not be alive. So I had all the medical stuff and then several boxes full of letters and parcels. Sometimes they sent medicine for their loved ones or just cards and stuff. So about the third time it didn't work out, I went back into the North Vietnamese embassy in Vientiane, and they said, Mr. Elder, could you do something for about a month? I thought, this is odd. I'm here. Sure, I could, but they said, well, because it's going to be very difficult for us to give you a visa for a while. I still had no idea what was going on. So at this point, since I was on that part of the world and the students were arriving in India, I turned around and went to India for a week or two, check up on the students in India. Flew back to Thailand. I was in Bangkok. And as I sat in the airport waiting for my plane, I saw the headlines, Ho Chi Minh died.
Oh, so they
that explained everything.
Everything.
He was dying, and they wanted to be ready for a funeral, and a Quaker coming around trying to deliver supplies wouldn't make much sense.
We're a little busy right now.
That's right. We got, and at that time, the Chinese and the Soviets weren't getting on with each other. So there had to be a Soviet delegation to mourn and a Chinese delegation to mourn. So I appreciated the complication of their life. So I went to the embassy in Vientiane and signed sort of condolence book and said, I'm leaving stuff here. I have to go back and start teaching. I'd love to come back, but some other Quaker will do it. But so just it's here and when you're ready. So I came back, classes started. And then in October of 69, the message came that they're ready to have somebody come take it in. And if I could come in a second time, that'd be great. So I found colleagues who were covering my classes for about a week and a weekend and flew back and delivered the supplies. And now the big question was, what are you doing with open heart surgery? And I learned a lot. Well, among other funny things, I carried a big book on thoracic surgery with me as reading for the plane, so I didn't have to weigh it. I also carried an unabridged American dictionary because the English translators are trying to figure out the words that are being used. There was something called a moratorium. They said, what's a moratorium? And their books didn't make any sense. After I delivered these two big books, they turned to, you know, moratorium. And you read it and it still doesn't make any sense. It's a hold of an economic process of some kind of delaying. But that was, you know, part of the fringe of going in there. So I saw the open heart equipment that they had. It was photographed with it. They were clearly doing open heart surgery. But what made sense, and until I got there and talked with them, I couldn't see how, why open heart surgery?
Right.
There's a lot of... heart disease among young people that leaves them virtually crippled in that part of the world. And if it makes it an 18-year-old into about an 80-year-old. And so the notion was that these are people who, with it, if you could take out the deteriorating valve and replace it with one of these artificial valves, they probably could live a reasonably healthy life for another two or three or four decades.
And they have the sort of the time to do this.
They have the time to do it, and they had the machinery. Hanoi wasn't bombed much during the war at all.
Right.
All around it. But I went to the hospital where the insulation was, where they took the pictures, and I talked to the surgeons who were doing it all. And they seemed to know exactly what they were doing. So I was pleased to come back and say that we were helping civilians and we were improving the lives of people who otherwise couldn't have been helped because they didn't have the sort of supplies and stuff.
So you weren't directly related in the later frustrations having to do with the, this would be what, in 1973, subsequent years, arguing about the shape of the conference table
before they even got down
to talk about things.
That was Henry Kissinger and the representative of the other side.
Went on and on.
I was glad it was happening, but our hospital in South Vietnam kept going all the way up to the end. And then we were able to get a few more supplies in, but mainly that was the one trip that I took in 1969 with the open-heart surgical stuff. Now, since then, since the Vietnam War has ended, this has been something which I've started, worked with Quakers here in Madison. We've set up a project called Madison Quakers, Inc. in My Lai, where the massacre occurred. And with the help of generous people here, we've built three schools in My Lai. And there's a park there and sort of commemorates what happened there. And so that sort of leaves you with a little bit of a better feeling about the way in which the war is going on. That's My Lai is in what used to be South Vietnam.
Yes.
And so that's an ongoing project that I've been involved with. And a veteran named Mike Bame, who's a Madison resident, is sort of his full-time job is raising money for that.
Another one of these situations that has gone on for years, like since 1953, when ostensibly there was a peace treaty signed,
right,
or at least a ceasefire between North and South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And those two seem like utterly intractable enemies, more so as each year progresses.
Right.
How did you get involved with that situation?
That was 1990. It was a time when there's always been a risk of a nuclear war there.
Yeah.
And the possibility of missiles being launched and all the rest. Things were getting a little tense. People were sounding like there might be an invasion. The North might invade the South if that happened.
The North in particular is always saber-rattling.
That's right, yeah. We're and when you look at the map, there's not a lot of distance between the ceasefire line and the capital.
Right.
So these things could happen. So there was particular concern that a lot of talk was going on. And by then there was a Quaker who had been in the Peace Corps in Korea and spoke Korean well. So we were asked by the American Quakers to go together and see if there were any way in which the tensions could be reduced if there were a talk between people in the North, people in the South, and people in Washington. So we went. Getting a visa is the real trick.
Yeah.
We had to negotiate something, which began in Saigon, and then we went to Beijing, and then we flew in from the north to get to
Phnom Penh. Cambodia.
Yeah.
Pyongyang.
Pyongyang, yeah. So going in there, and we were treated very, very well by all sorts of high representatives. And heard their conversation about the way in which they felt the constant threat of the Americans saying, you know, we could, it's sort of the other side of the coin where you're being told that they could be attacked and wiped out very quickly. Then there were these maneuvers being carried out in the Navy on the east side of the sea there with Korea. And every time that happened, it could be a matter of just deciding, well, now we're going to bomb because we have all the equipment up there. So the notion was to keep the temperature down, why don't we not have these maneuvers off the coast? Mm-hmm. And to keep the temperature down, why don't you remove nuclear missiles from South Korea? The fact that they're there, once again, just raises the temperature. So to the extent there was a request made, could you, you know, we're not getting on well with each other, but if you could ease these things that make the flames hotter, that would probably help. So we did carry that message from North Korea to South Korea to, and at that time, Ted Kennedy was a major figure. They felt Ted was Kennedy, the one who was interested in working out something there. We never met Ted Kennedy himself, but we did meet his representative, and there was, and could tell them that we had met Ted Kennedy's staff person.
Did you have any sense in North Korea of how the people really felt, especially about the leadership?
You can only guess. It was eerie to be there because the public, what the public saw was so restricted. There was a gigantic painting in the downtown mall of the leader of North Korea standing there lecturing to the intellectuals of the world. And there's a crowd of people from Africa and the Soviet Union and the United States who are taking notes as Kim Il-sung elucidates Juche socialism. Mm-hmm. And then there's a central library, and the central library had the collected works of the great leader in 35 languages or something like that. So all the evidence you would get there was that this is a gigantic intellectual who's leading the world, mm-hmm. and we are where all the wisdom is. Then you get into the countryside or look at the machinery. The buses were derelict almost. You see tractors that nobody would be riding here that were in such bad shape. And then you'd see soldiers out there working in the fields because there weren't enough people out there to help with the harvest. So it was clear that this was not something that was where people were doing exceedingly well. And then the military were a large part of the population, which is part of, again, building up this notion that we have a very large defense force, which will protect us if the South decides to do something or the U.S. decides to do something.
Are they really that paranoid? I mean, where do they get these ideas?
I think they generate among themselves, and they certainly, you know, pick up statements from the rest of the world that this is something, what the North Koreans are doing is unacceptable. We may have to prevent them from doing it, and preventing could be, you know, dropping a nuclear weapon on capital city or, you know, wherever. So it's certainly encouraged by the way the dialogue, you hear the threat from the other side. We can say we're not seriously thinking of wiping out their civilization, whereas they can say, but you certainly sound like that. And then, you know, they launch a missile and we say, you're threatening the world, we may have to do something serious, and it generates itself.
Did you ever have a conversation with a North Korean that you felt wasn't, scripted or orchestrated or controlled or
my friend
watched?
Who spoke Korean well would speak to cooks and people like that. Mm-hmm. And no, they could certainly not express anything other than general support for what was being said, because they could see who we were, and we were almost always with somebody who could translate what was going on. So it was bizarre because we were in a hotel that looked like every modern hotel you'd have here, the Holiday Inn type thing, with menus and multiple choices. There'd be Canadians there. There'd be people from all over the world, businessmen talking. There was even the hotel we stayed in that went to a restaurant that rotated sort of in 1 hour, so you could see mm-hmm. the great view of the city of Pyongyang. Funny thing there, the music that was being played was brilliant and accurate and very, very sort of World War II-ish. There was Moonlight in Vermont and some
really?
Of these old
so
songs.
Like big band music, that kind of thing. Just a little behind.
And it was so accurate. I got to find the piano player who's doing this. Uh-huh. So I took a break from dinner and to wander around and see where this was. It was a player piano. There were all these keys doing their
Somehow that just seems like a fitting way to end it, Joe.
That's right. It's playing perfect piano music, Pink Panther.
Lockstep.
Lockstep, right, yeah.
Well, Joe Elder, it's been a great pleasure hearing about your experiences as an international peace broker, kind of in the shadows and laying the groundwork for, larger negotiations that followed. And
again, the impressive thing is that at the top, what people often have to sound belligerent. And when they have a quieter moment and realize they may be able to convey a message to somebody on the other side, they often are more reasonable than one would think. And the fact that they kept giving us time, they're busy people, and to stop and talk to three Quakers who have no power at all, always impressed us.
Well, it's an impressive dossier that you have, Joe, as a diplomat, as a messenger. And thanks for sharing those experiences.
Thanks for inviting me.
My guest has been Joe Elder, international peace broker and professor of sociology, languages, and cultures of Asia at the UW-Madison. I'm Norman Gilliland. This has been University of the Air.